Well, hey everybody, it's Chuck. Welcome back to the apiary. I know it's been a few weeks, but it's been hot and the chores have been heavy. And there are two videos I tried to make that the camera gave me some problems and they never got published. So it has been a little bit of a hiatus, but I figured I would give you guys a recap video, especially of the things I covered in those videos that didn't make it to YouTube because of camera issues I had. One of them was in the rain and I was trying to get my last demaray for you, Trudy, because you asked for that. And it was in the rain, and I guess I didn't hit the button to record after I did my intro. So the intro worked, but none of the beehive stuff did. In any case, I'm out here in the apiary, and I'm just going to kind of do a selfie cam walkthrough, a little bit of discussion of some things I have in work and what I've been doing. You know, the martins have all had their babies, and they're starting to fledge, and yeah, those are my queen eaters. Yes, purple martins will definitely eat your mating queens, that's for sure, but it's all part of the circle of life, and I'm just as happy to have the purple martins as I am the bees. But what I want to show you is kind of where the status of my hives are today. I've taken everything down, and as I mentioned in a previous video, I'm also in the middle of a queen transition. I'm transitioning all of my queens to Varroa Sensitive Hygiene, VSH, as measured by the Harbo assay. Corey's the one, Corey Stevens is promoting most of this, Stevens Bee Co. Others are using techniques like UBO is another technique to measure this. Randy Oliver is doing it through just mite checks and counts like that, keeping the mites low, but through genetics, meaning like the actual workers of VSH queens cap and recap worker larvae and do not allow reproductive mites. And that's the big difference. You can still have mites, but not successfully reproductive mites. The current theory is that the workers are uncapping mites when they can smell the foundress Varroa mite reproducing in there. I'm switching to VSH mostly because I don't want to be treatment free. I'm not saying that or anything, but I would like to spot treat on the hives that do not show this ability of keeping the mites at bay. And one of the major reasons I think we need to make this transition as quickly as we can is because tropolelapse is coming. Tropolelapse is, the mite is not here in the United States. It's mostly in Asia and starting to move its way into Eastern Europe. And I'm hoping, and we don't have any evidence of this that I've read yet, that the VSH genetic alleles will also help us fight tropolelapse when it gets here. So I think it's important that we start thinking about this way, especially those of us that raise our own queens. Obviously, because I'm not doing instrumental insemination yet in my lab, I am open mating. So I am getting the genetics from the queen as reproduced in her worka combined with the drone larva or drones that are open mated in this area. So it's not a perfect scenario, but the more drones you can put in the area, the better chances you'll have of continuing to breed for those specific traits. And my method of measuring this will be the Harbo assay, unless we come up with anything better along the way, which involves pulling pupa, looking for reproductive mites, and actually giving a score of 1 to 4, basically, the Harbo score, 4 being the highest, 100% completely VSH, do not allow reproductive mites. So in any case, I do have 3 queens coming from Randy Oliver. So his Golden West queens, they're not labeled VSH, they're just mite resistant and gentle from California. Don't know how those are gonna work, but I've got 3 of those that are being delivered probably in the next couple days. I did get 3 from Sourwood Farms. He's got a couple queens that are measuring Harbo 4s, and I said, hey, listen, if you're documenting Harbo 4s, I'll take some of those genetics. And I also have some of Corey Stevens' queens that were sent to me. Only one of which successfully came back open mated, but she has been the queen that has given me all of the queen cells I've made to this point. And I've probably made around 70 queen cells, of which, you know, some of them didn't make it all through. But I made every single one of those queen cells in the last remaining demaray that I had functioning and as just a complete starter finisher. I do think that the demaray starter finisher technique does not give you a full rack of 45 cells finished like perhaps a true finisher would. They did start breaking down a few cells, I think, but I don't know whether to blame that on my grafting, on the larva, or on just the queenless state of the hive and the population. But you know, if I put 45 in there and I get 21 out, that is almost perfect for me just because I don't have that many places to put cells all at once. So the numbers actually kind of work out. So in any case, I'm going to turn you around just a little bit and kind of show you through. So what I've done here is every single one of my production hives has been taken down to two deeps with a double screen board, and I've got either a virgin or a queen cell in every single one of these that is essentially gonna create two queens per hive. And most of this is for redundancy. If one of them doesn't mate, I'll recombine and we'll have one, but essentially I had all these cells. So right there, we've got 14 potential queens. Here is the big dim array that, you know, I know Trudy, you wanted me to see break into that, so I'm just gonna have you talk you through it. And the double queen colony here, we had a queen in this one and a queen in this one and a combined super technique. This one was the dim array going all the way up, and I've got this one split with a double screen board also. One interesting thing I wanna say I found on the double queen colony that was a little bit of a finding. When I opened it up, the hive on the left was queenless. The hive on the right did have a queen that I removed, and right now these are both queenless because they are waiting on Randy Oliver's queens. But the hive on the left had no evidence of queen cells. The hive on the right was queen right. So it's like it was queenless, but happy that it was queenless. And I'm thinking it was because of the combined workers working up here in this super together. So I think the true way of saying this is not the same as a double screen board creating two separate hives. This is a way of keeping two queens happily working together on a common workforce, which would be the supers up above. But when this one went queenless, it did not act queenless. It just acted like it was a second deep that was to the side of the queen right hive, which was a little bit of a lesson learned. So think of a two queen system like this, not as a double screen board split where they're both essentially queenless, but it allows two queens to work together. That's where I am on my theory on this now, with what I saw. Now, I probably will put my hood on and maybe pull the smoker out, because I do want to show you in here, I've got all of my queens that I pulled. So I essentially had, I'm gonna put my hood on while I talk to you guys. I put all of the queens that I pulled, and see, this is still split. And this is an unfinished super, meaning like it did not have capped honey in it. It just had honey that needed to be consumed or continue to be built here. But this white frame here is what I wanted to show you. Break it off on both sides with the propolis. So this is now a queenless hive though, so I am a little risky going in here with no gloves, because I did remove the queen from the right side, so it's double queenless. But there's my queen bank. Now, this queen bank is essentially just keeping the queens that I pulled from my other hives that I either hadn't sold or whatever alive for a period of time. Now granted, they are not laying, so when they're not laying, there's a limit on the amount of time you can keep them like this, and I don't know what that limit is. Some people have said you can overwinter this way, I'm not sure. But they're all still in there working around. Now I did realize on these cages I was making that the holes I had on my previous cages were too big. I had to shrink the hole size down on these cages because I had like a 3.5 millimeter hole, and there were some aggressive workers that were able to get in through the holes I was making in these cages. So I had to shrink it down a little bit so they're essentially isolated. But this queen bank, there's workers in there. I don't know that the workers need to be in there. Remember, I learned that the workers were very helpful with virgins hatching. I don't think you have to have workers in there, but essentially they're keeping them content and alive on top of a queenless colony. Now, I guess my experiment is gonna continue to go, how long will they keep them fed? How long can I keep this hive queenless and them be satisfied and not essentially breaking down the cells? They're not breaking down the cells, but breaking down, killing the queens and stopping feeding them, I guess is what would happen. over here in the mini mating nuke yard. This is kind of where I am right now. These here in this section do not have bees in them. All of the ones further spaced out do. I do think that I had too many in this one area, and my queen return rate was fairly low. I think they went into the wrong hives. Maybe I looked at them too much. I don't know. But in any case, I do have a couple that are caged up right now that I just put some bees in, and these are still closed up. And I got a lot of extra queen cells, and I just put a few of them into those hives over there, which I think is good. Another thing, I'm just gonna kind of randomly talk to you guys about things that are going on. So if I were to show you this, what do you think I got going on? What does that look like? It looks like pollen to me. And I've got a brick here. See if I can do this with one hand. I think I can. These are pollen-bound frames. What do you guys do with your pollen-bound frames? I have made a video in the past on doing this process, so this is not a video about this, but I soak my pollen-bound frames in water to soften up those entombed capsules. And I'll set this camera down, see if I can get you a little bit of a how I do this on this video. But I want you guys to go to my other video on this if you want to see a full video on how I do it. This camera may or may not work very well. But essentially, once you soak these, and these have been soaking overnight, you get a stream of water, and that pollen will, I'm not gonna say it's gonna come out perfectly, but it definitely comes out. The longer you soak it, you can multi-soak it. And many of you may go, God, just scrape that off and start over again. I would say that is a perfectly fine answer, depending on how much drawn comb you have as a beginner, or if you need to keep drawn comb around. If they've drawn this out, and the worst thing is it's entombed with too much pollen, you can get it out of there. This is one technique on doing that. Now, it doesn't all come out at once. You shake the water out. There's still some in there, but kind of what I wanted to show you is what I was doing in this bucket on how I rescue some entombed pollen frames. I use the brick to kind of keep them under the water so it soaks overnight. Those have been soaking overnight. Sometimes it takes a little bit more time than that. And I'm working with a few other things to maybe help emulsify that pollen a little bit better. More to come on that. But this is also why I haven't been videoing. I don't like to video the whole extraction process. I've done that in the past also, and it's kind of a labor job, and I don't know. But what I have done here is completely extracted all of these. The bees have licked them all clean. And one thing I do want to talk about is I've sprayed them with my BT. Bacillium thuringiensis is what I think it is. BT for short. It's a bacteria, and I put it in this Talente thing. It comes in a bag, but the brand I use is called Zentari with an X. X-E-N-T-A-R-I BT. It's a organic natural bacteria that, when diluted, this is a powder, so it can be shelf stable on here. I like to kind of put the date on here. I don't like to keep the powder for like more than 5 or 6 years. There isn't an actual expiration date for Zentari, but you're just gonna have to guess, does that bacteria stay stable forever? It probably depends on your storage. If you kept it in the freezer, maybe it would last even longer. Is it kind of like a yeast that lasts forever if you keep it in the right, I don't know. Any case, I use 5 years for Zentari, and I believe I use 4 teaspoons per gallon, and I use it in a spray bottle, like a big 2 gallon pump sprayer, and I pull out every single frame, and I spray each side with Zentari. That is how I fight wax moths, and my wax combs for almost a decade and a half now have never had wax moth issues in storage in an open shed. I don't have a large cooler. I don't have anywhere else to do it. It is a big job to do it that way, so it's probably a sideliner or a hobbyist technique to use Zentari or to do the BT individual spray. I don't know if I can spray. Let me ask you guys, is anybody else using BT, and how lazy can you be? Can you just spray the box with it and hope enough gets in there, or do you really need to get it on every single cell? Do you need to spray it every single year? My thought is that if they put honey in it and you cap it out, then the Zentari is gone. The BT is gone. Zentari is a brand. It's the bacteria. In any case, I spray mine every year. It doesn't hurt honey. It is honey safe. There's all those things about putting things on your comb. BT is a well-known natural way of fighting wax moths. It's just a little bit labor intensive, but all of these have been sprayed and they're drying out. I did them yesterday. So these are ready to go into storage just to kind of get out of the way. Some people do pole barns. I put it up in the top of my barn shed, which has got a second story up in there. And that's how I do my combs. But if I were to come into the shed, you guys have been in here before, but that was my honey take this year. There's about 110 gallons there that came out of those honey supers you saw. And that's a pretty good year for me out of, you know, considering I only have about 10 or 11 production hives. Everything else is resource hives in my apiary. But what else we got going on back here? Here's my incubator. Can you guys, is the light good enough back here? I got queen cells that are going to be ripening soon, and it's right there at 93 degrees. My 3D printer is currently printing a new design of a queen cage I'm going to use. I'm going to use these on Randy Oliver's queens because they are going to be mated queens and mated introduction cages. You know, there's a lot of ways of doing it, but you know, these kind of eighth inch wire cages, or I'm making these out of plastic. But remember I told you before that my cages I was using allowed the bees to go through it. Oh, actually, let me turn the light on and I can actually show you what I meant by that. Because I didn't throw the old cages away because they're good for just kind of storage, but they're not so good. So can you see the difference on the holes on this side? Let me do them side by side with the old and the new. There you go. This was the bigger hole I was using that the bees could actually squeeze themselves through. So there's about 5 to 10% of the bees, maybe they were the younger bees that just hatched, but they were able to wriggle themselves through these holes. So I shrunk the hole size of my cage, which is working good. And I'm also 3D printing these kind of copies of a queen introduction cage. I don't have any flap. It's got a door with a ridge on it, and it kind of closes like that with a regular feeding tube scenario. I'm doing this one-handed. And it, you know, it closes up just like that. But because I realized the hole size was important, I had to redo these plastic cages that I did have that were using this dimension over here that was a little bit larger. What else have I got that I've 3D printed recently? I modified my frame holder. If you guys remember this before, this was my frame holder. It's a plastic one that goes like this, and the frame goes in the middle of these. Well, these inner arms were actually so long, they were actually squishing some of the honey. So I took the exact same design and I shrunk the inner arms to just the width of a frame so that a frame can actually hold itself in there. And this is for grafting, and this is for my Harbo assay checking and things like that. That's what this is about. And also, for those of you that are doing Harbo assays that watch my channel, I 3D printed a pupa storage tray. So as I'm picking the pupa out, and I'll do a video on the Harbo assay later when I start doing them. When I pick the pupa out, I can put 5 pupa in each one of these to give me my counts as I go through. I have printed a sheet like I like to do with my Harbo scores and things like that, so I don't need to memorize this stuff on how to handle that as I do this. So as you can see, you know, I've got magnification going. There's a lot of parts of doing these sort of things, and that's kind of what's going on in the shed at the moment. But really, I'm cleaning up. That's the hot knife I use. If you guys had never bought a hot knife, spend the extra money on the one with the thermostat. Those Chinese ones without a thermostat control will tease you into buying them. The heating elements in these things are a fire hazard, I'll tell you. And this is how you manage and control heat. And the little yellow range up there, I usually leave mine just above 6.5 to 7 on this scale. But if I stop for a few minutes, I need to turn it down because this will get too hot just sitting there with honey on it. I use this little Harbor Freight lift stand to kind of get my uncapping bucket up at a nice height. Oh, this is a life lesson I'm just gonna teach you guys. I buy these trays off of Amazon. Those are like trays you might put underneath a hot water heater if the hot water heater was inside your house. I have had these buckets crack in the years past. If you use a 5-gallon bucket for more than 5 years or so, they do get brittle. So now I've got most of the buckets that are gonna stay in here inside of these trays. In case they do start a leak, it will hopefully stay in the tray. That is another experiment, but I have had buckets crack, and that is a crying shame when it happens. What else have I got in here? This is Chuck's homemade bee vac. I just had this little shop vac here, and I've got the suction port goes in here, and I've got a screen in there, and I've just got a frame in here. The reason I need a small bee vac is because the bees get in my windows while I'm doing extraction. If I crack the door open, and here's a good example of a little lady. I've only got one, but sometimes there are dozens of bees that get in here. So it's not quite as good of a bee vac as the one you would really buy or make if you were doing extractions like Randy, a dirt rooster, does. You know, you need something better than that, but that's just my little, my bee vac. What other changes I've made? So there's my sugar stand these days. It stays on the cinder blocks. This is a new addition though. I did put this valve on the bottom of this bucket because what I was finding is I had built this pouring spout mechanism to pour into my jug. This is my 3-gallon jug modification that I use for feeders. And I have a tiny little one for doing my mini mating nukes. But having a valve on the bottom of this, much like a honey gate, was just something that made it easier. Because I make this stuff up in this big pot and it stays in there, but then I need an easy way of filling up my portable one that lets me fill up my feeders. We're just going kind of going on and on and on. Maybe we need to wrap this up. I do have one more thing I want to show you. It's my honey cappings and how I finish letting the bees have the honey, and then I put them in my solar wax melter. I can show you the solar wax melter I use. Can you see it out there? It lives out here in the sun facing to the south. This is a homemade wax melter. It is not a large one, but it will fill up a tray pan. And the way I've made mine is I've got this little pivot arm here, and that pivot arm and the length of that is the height. I've got a couple wheels so I can drag it. I do have a thermometer that goes inside, and you kind of see I've got a tray up top where the schmuck and the honey cappings go, and then just a tray at the bottom. This works great. It's a double, you know, I had a double pane window off of an old house I just saved, and that's all that is. It is a double pane window, and the spraying it black just kind of keeps it ready to go and then absorbs as much heat as it can. It works great. If I were to say what I don't like about it is it's volume constrained. I don't need one bigger than that because half the time I'm just putting in little scraps that I pull off of the, you know, edges of combs and stuff. But this time of year when I have a lot of cappings for a little, you know, beekeeper, that thing is just not big enough to do it all at once. You know, you can boil it in a pot and do that sort of stuff, but I like having the solar wax melter there year round to handle that. So the last thing I'm gonna show you is the cappings and how I, so this is all the cappings I got. It's in one bucket. I just leave my stuff out here for the bees to clean up. Now, this cappings bucket, you know, has a screen on the bottom, and there's some honey in here. This is the honey gate where you kind of do get most of the honey off, but I've already bled most of it off that would drip out. I left that in the shed for about 4 days, and it dripped all it was gonna drip with that much wax. Now granted, with that much wax, it's also acting like a sponge and holding honey, but the bees are gonna get the rest of it. And they will bore through this and make tunnels and get every bit of wax separated from the honey, and they'll eat the honey. And then these cappings will be both in the top and the bottom bucket, ready to go into the wax melter. If you're doing the boiling method, it all comes out in the water. But in the solar wax melter, minimizing the amount of, wax or schmuck in the cappings is better because it makes cleaner bricks and you don't have to redo it as much. So that's my update, and that's kind of why I haven't been making videos. I do feel bad I didn't get the one out about the demarais. I did kind of want to show that. I think that the lesson on the demarais was I'm definitely doing it next year. I'm probably going to do a couple early and power feed in January so that I have some super strong hives that are gonna swarm early, and I'll do the demarais on them. So I have some hives in February that are ready to make queens in the top half like I learned I can do. So I do wanna have a demarais complete by Valentine's Day. I'm in the middle of queen swapping out everything to a VSH daughter right now. And then we're gonna be mixing in Randy Oliver's Golden West queens. I have to come up with some other sort of marking mechanism to keep these colors separate so I'll know who's who in the zoo. You know, our queens are just not lasting as long anymore. They're lasting 2 years, maybe 2.5. So you really don't need 5 colors anymore for queens. You know, I think the oldest queen I had was a red or a green one. So, you know, the fourth and fifth year colors are kind of available if you wanted to use those, or just come up with another one, like a pink or a purple or something like that. What else? And the two queen hive and the queen bank was something else I did want to show you guys that I think is important. So I learned a lot there. I'm going to kind of keep a two queen system going. That vertical two queen system I had was as strong as it could be. If you remember that one I did, it was as strong. It had, you know, 8 frames of brood in there. There's a chance that I'm going to have to really feed these hives that I split to keep them alive, because I did take most of the supers off. So they, you know, only have the honey they had in the deeps that I left in there, not any sort of medium. So I'm going to, that's why I got the feed bucket out, and you saw me doing that. I'll make sure I got feed on them to keep them going. We're still in a little bit of a flow here. I did notice that our palmetto and things like that are blooming. That's not a huge forage source for me here, but if you're a little bit further west or a little bit more out in the country, that palmetto stuff is a great nectar source. But I just don't get as much of that here on the west side of Jacksonville. In any case, that's my update for you guys. Hopefully we'll have some more information soon. If something kind of comes up, maybe with these queens and getting them going, I'll do a little bit more filming on that. And I will be doing the Harbo assays in the video, but I need to wait about 7 weeks before I can test any of these daughters, because the entire worker force has to be replaced by her progeny before I can measure anything. So have a great day, everybody, and we'll see you next time.